Marshall, if you'd like to start us off.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Ross, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are here for our third oral argument of the day, and I am afraid of trying to pronounce these names and butchering them. So this case is A20-1383 in the marriage of, and I'm just, you'll introduce yourself, but it's the Jayawardena versus Jayawardena. You each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. So I believe we are ready to begin, and if counsel for appellant could start stating your name and the party you represent for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. John Burns, may it please the court, and I represent the appellant Dinesh Jayawardena. This case originates from a trial in 2018 before the Honorable Patrick Robin, who had excluded credit card debt from Mr. Jayawardena's budget over concerns that it may duplicate other listed expenses. Duplication, that was the only reason given for not including the monthly payments of the credit card debt on Mr. Jayawardena's budget. And on appeal, respondents did not raise any other basis to exclude this from the budget. So with this record, this court reversed the district court on the grounds that it erred in not including this debt in his budget. And you held, quote, father's prior expenditures for groceries and clothing, et cetera, cannot duplicate future monthly expenses towards those items. And the district court clearly erred by excluding that expense from father's budget. And that error necessarily undermines the district court's calculation of spousal maintenance and child support. We therefore reverse these awards and remand them for the district court to recalculate father's budget and reevaluate spousal maintenance and child support accordingly. Unfortunately, on remand before a new judicial officer, the Honorable Margaret Daly, the court felt that it had the ability to evaluate the debt presented at the 2018 trial. And based upon that review, 2 years later, Judge Daly found for the first time that the debts were not verified to her satisfaction. So she excluded them and made no changes to the spousal maintenance and child support awards. And this appeal follows. The primary issue on appeal is whether the district court abused its discretion in refusing to follow this court's mandate. And the answer from our perspective is clearly that they did.
If I can just ask a question factually, from the first judgment and decree from which appeal was taken, is there anything more specific by way of a finding other than that there is a marital debt on the visa that is the husband's own expenses, and specifically as to the amount of that debt?
Mr. Jayawardena was representing himself pro se, Your Honor, at the underlying time of the case, but there is reference made to the debt that Judge Robin makes in his findings. He denotes the amount, and he's more concerned with the marital versus non-marital characteristic than any additional documentation of it. He clearly accepts it because he assigns it to Mr. Jayawardena, but specifically, there's not any additional reference to what you're requesting.
Right. So he accepts that there is a debt, but we don't know. I can't see in that original judgment decree an amount of the debt or an amount of the monthly expense. Am I right?
I'd have to refer back, and I can certainly do that when Ms. Wolfer is talking.
Have it handy. That's fine. I don't want to get too hung up on it, but It seems like there may be something missing from that original judgment and decree. There may be.
Right. So my take, and again, I wasn't counsel at trial. But I know that when we brought it up, the only concern was as to this debt, whether or not it's duplicated. Are we saying clothing is covered both in your credit card expense and in your clothing expense? So that was the issue that was raised. I don't know the backup documentation that was provided in the record, respectfully. But what's critical is that that duplication issue was the only issue that this court had before it when we came up on appeal the first time. And opposing counsel had the opportunity to raise, if they wanted to, the issue of there wasn't enough documentation, or we questioned some of the debts, or they were for some purpose that should not be considered. But none of that was done. And so when this court made its order, there was no expectation that on remand, there was going to be an examination of the credit card documents. That was simply not an issue. And critically, the failure to argue that on the first appeal precludes respondent as a matter of law from arguing that on remand.
Can I ask, and respondent was a respondent in the first appeal, is that right?
That is correct.
So if the first appeal, the issue that appellant raised was there's duplication, and we decide, yes, we see duplication. Why is that? Is that a forfeiture by a respondent of other issues that the respondent maybe could have raised on a notice of related appeal or something, should they lose on the duplication? But is that forfeiture of the issue now?
Respectfully, I would argue that it is. So in the Huntsman case that I cite on page 6 of my brief, I explain that if there's another argument that could be made, it needs to be made at that time. And the reason is to make sure that the Court of Appeals, the reviewing court, has all possible bases that the district court could have relied upon to reach its conclusion. What we end up with is this situation otherwise, where potentially the issue is bouncing back and forth between the Court of Appeals and the district court, as the district court keeps coming up with new justifications to support the conclusion they want to reach, which is we don't want to change maintenance.
Yeah, I'm thinking though, I mean, the district court needs an opportunity, even if something should have been included in the budget, right? If we decide in our initial appeal that was a problem, there's duplication. We still don't know, in the absence of duplication, how a district court would exercise its discretion in evaluating a corrected budget and just making determinations thereafter. So I'm wondering, you know, what's the forfeiture? We couldn't really decide how it should be decided until the district court actually makes a decision how to evaluate it.
Well, but the Court of Appeals decision prior to this action did make a legal determination, and that becomes the law of the case. When it's sent back and it says, as to the only issue presented to us, this argument of duplication, that fails. So we're saying that the $1,716 a month that you thought was a duplication is not. And because no other arguments have been made, we are saying you must give him that credit on his budget. And then the discretion that you gave the district court was to say, with that adjustment, what should be the maintenance? What should be the child support?
I can just interrupt. Are you saying that the record after the as of the time we remanded was that he had to get $1,716.19 as a credit?
Yes, that is our position, that the only reading of the Court of Appeals decision, the only authority given back to the district court, was he gets this credit. There's not a duplication. That simply doesn't hold up. There's no merit to that logically. So that when that credit is applied, all you have to do, remand court, is to determine maintenance and child support. No, there was no broad discretion given or expected because, again, the issue was not raised. And I think Huntsman, and I believe in my reply brief, the Southside Plumbing case, really identified that because of that, and because the legal determination was made, that there is no ability to come in and say, well, here's an argument I could have made, or here's an argument that I should have made. You lose that ability if you haven't preserved that issue. There's a res judicata concern, there's estoppel concerns that are all detailed in our brief. But the key takeaway is this. The trial record closed, and then the appeal was taken, and then all arguments were made on that, and this court made its decision. That decision has to then be followed by the district court. The district.
I want to think through, though, a little bit more because it really is dependent on you slicing out other challenges to the 1700. So if the district court made an error in based on the duplicating expenses, right, but made no other judgment in its, as to like the validity of the amount monthly or as to even the validity of debt, et cetera, it made no findings of fact, exercised no discretion about it. On the first appeal, if the appellant, says, yeah, they're duplicated, what would the respondent's obligation be to raise? I mean, they couldn't say the district court clearly erred or abused its discretion in finding it valid because the district court didn't do that yet. Or the district court, abused its discretion in the amount because it didn't do that yet. So why would those arguments be forfeited if the district court had not yet done those things?
Simply because there has to be a notice and an expectation for that argument to be made. You can't make for the first time on a remand an argument that could have occurred at the time that you were in court, or a justification to otherwise support the conclusion at the Court of Appeals. The idea is that when this court made its decision, you did so based upon all available arguments that could be made. The district court said duplication's my only concern. That's all that Judge Robin raises on the 1716. He never makes a finding that I'm concerned about whether there was frivolous spending, or whether I have enough documents or anything else.
Right, he never made those findings. So how could the respondent have said it was error? Those findings were erroneous, they're non-existent. Wouldn't they be exactly what should be go back? I mean, wouldn't that be what it would be remanded for, to actually make those findings that were not made because of a mistake we decided and another reasoning?
If that had been the conclusion of the Court of Appeals our first time up here, possibly that scope of remand could have been made, but we were concise that as to the only basis that was found, it was rejected, and hence on the remand for the first time, that argument cannot be made, nor can the district court judge expand what the direction she's been given, and that's really our argument, is that this failure to follow the mandate is what occurred. I agree with the court that different decisions could have been made at different times, but the fact that the record in front of this court and the decision that came out of it very clearly limits the district court's power to make that change and then go to the maintenance and child support. That's what we have for this case. That is our law of the case. And the law of the case can't be changed later by the district court, because we get this exact issue where we're down to this is a 2018 decree. My client, from our perspective, has overpaid maintenance now by $62,000 minimum. And so this back and forth process is what occurs if the potential justification for why a decision was made is not presented for you to evaluate. I've had a lot of appeals where I've come up and said, well, even if you don't like the way the judge ruled, here's another way that you could look at it, and I get to the same conclusion. And that opportunity to buttress the district court's position is something that you do.
I'm curious, if we agree with you, you've asked for a remand again, what is the specific instruction you would ask us to direct the district court to follow?
I would ask that it be remanded with a clear instruction to first include the $1,716 per month obligation in Mr. Jayawardena's budget, and then second, to determine how that additional budget item changes the spousal maintenance and child support obligations of the parties in this case. And I see my time is expiring. So with that explanation.
May I ask one more question, Judge Smith?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Sorry.
No worries.
Go right ahead.
I'm looking at Judge Bjorkman's opinion right now. And yes. The way the words are that the father will continue to incur expenses toward those items and will continue to face an obligation to pay off his credit card. Not that he will continue to have an expense of $1,700 and whatever it is dollars, just that it's an obligation. And then it goes on, then she goes on, Judge Bjorkman goes on to say we remand to the district court to recalculate father's budget and reevaluate spousal maintenance and child support accordingly. So there does seem to have been more room for the district court on remand than what you're suggesting. If Judge Bjorkman is a good enough writer and an experienced enough judge, that if she meant to say on this record you have to give him credit for $1,700 and whatever dollars, she would have said that.
And I have argument in our brief response to that, Your Honor, and as to the designation of what was identified. The key is that the only justification presented by the court, Judge Robin, the only justification argued on appeal by a respondent's counsel has always been duplication. So having satisfied duplication, it is our position that the new discretion, the new arguments that were made violate the law in the ways that we laid out in our briefs. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the respondent, you have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Tiffany Wolter and I represent the respondent in this matter, Molly Karaj Jayawardena. Your honors, I believe that we just kind of hit the nail in the head with the conversation that we just had with Mr. Burns there. The instructions here did not say what Mr. Burns just, answered Judge Ross's question as to what the instructions should be if you remand. Those are not the instructions that Judge Bjorkman gave the trial court to do. The trial court was instructed specifically to recalculate father's budget and then reevaluate spousal maintenance and child support accordingly. So the trial court was directed by the Court of Appeals to do an investigation into the budget, to do an investigation into the number that should be inserted into the budget regarding the credit card debt. And so what happened was we all went back and we came and we reviewed father's budget regarding his expense for the amount of his credit card debt. And we all realized that this number of $716 was invented from thin air.
Before we get there, and your description also of we sent it back to investigate, those words don't appear. Judge Bjorkman didn't say that either.
Correct.
What it says is, father, and let's see, blah, blah, blah. The district, it talks about the credit card. The district court clearly erred by excluding that expense from father's budget. That error, excluding it, necessarily undermines the district court's calculation of spousal maintenance child support period, we therefore reverse those awards and remand for the district court to recalculate father's budget and reevaluate spousal maintenance, et cetera, accordingly. You read those three sentences in a row. What's wrong with the argument that the error identified was exclusion from the budget? Therefore, we're sending it back to recalculate. There's no investigation mentioned.
Well, no, but my opinion is that the Court of Appeals said, okay, there is a credit card expense here now. Go take a look at what that credit card expense is, and then come up with a number to put into the budget for calculation of spousal maintenance and child support. The problem that we found, though, was that when we went to figure out what that number should be in Mr. J. Wardina's budget, we couldn't accurately come up with a number. There was just no way to do that given the evidence that was in the record to put a number into the budget.
But there is a debt, right?
There is a debt that exists.
And correct. It's like $30,000.
Correct. But the statements that he provided at trial were more than a year old. The payments ranged from $0 a month to $14,000 a month. The minimum payments requested, were from like $200 a month to $1,900 a month. There was evidence that the debt had been charged off, that it was sent to collections, that it had then been sent to a law firm for lawsuit. There was just no evidence in the record that Mr. J. Wardina had ever had a conversation with anyone from the law firm who the debt had been sold to as to, yeah, we'll accept monthly payments of $716 per month. We don't know if they would have accepted $50 per month. We don't know if they would have accepted $5,000 per month.
But we know for sure that they wouldn't have accepted $0 per month?
Well, we don't know that either. Maybe it would have been, hindsight is 2020. We know what they've accepted over the past however many years. But
you can't service debt. You can't service $30,000 worth of debt by never making a payment on it.
Well, it's obviously up to the law firm to begin collection on that debt
Isn't it up to the district court on remand to determine what is the reasonable monthly expense to service that debt, whether the law firm agrees or they have a deal or don't? I mean, it seems like that's the determination that hasn't yet been made. What is the reasonable monthly amount that would have to be paid to service the debt that we know exists and has been allocated to the father?
Yes, but the problem is that father never provided any evidence as to what that might be. So therefore, the court had no ability to assess that amount, and which is why the court said this amount is zero because it's unsubstantiated. We can't figure out what
evidence would you expect? I mean, the existence of the debt seems to be established by records. Mm-hmm. The fact of a variety of different amounts of payments, perhaps attributable to different amounts of money that were available to make a payment. So there's evidence of payment made, I think that you said.
There's not, no.
Oh, there's no evidence that he ever made a payment on the debt?
He made payments in 2017 and the trial was in 2018. He hadn't made a payment in more than a year on the debt.
Okay, so what else would need to be in there? Are you saying that he needed to start without evidence that he was actually in fact making a monthly payment of a certain amount, then that means that there is not evidence of a budget item?
Well, I think we would look to the guidance of the Rask case, right? Where you have to have some evidence as to what the amount is that would be accepted for payment and that that payments would actually be made in the future on this debt. So, an agreement, like some sort of letter or something from the law firm that had the debt that we will enter into a payment plan with you. The payment plan will be $500 per month, something of that nature.
What did Rask involve? Was that a established debt?
No, wife needed to have housing. The fact that it was established that she would need to live somewhere.
So it was future housing. It wasn't, for example, an existing contract for deed or mortgage payment. It was, okay, so here we have an existing debt. I think that's the difference as I looked at the, you know, the cases cited is there's no question, but there's the debt here. It's just how much is a reasonable monthly amount to service it, I think. Unlike other cases, which was they haven't yet bought a car or haven't yet bought the house. And I guess, you know, in terms of you're saying that in order to prove what the reasonable monthly amount was, he needed evidence to show what the creditor would accept.
Yes. Yes, there is no evidence here as to what that is. And how is the trial court supposed to properly assess the issue of spousal maintenance and child support and a proper budget for Mr. J. Guardina when we do not know where that $716 amount came from? Like I said before, it came essentially out of thin air. There is not one document, not one statement, and Mr. J. Guardina did not even testify regarding that amount of $716. There's just nothing out there to support that whatsoever. So then
can you get to the question of then what about the argument though that none of this was raised as an alternative basis for affirming in the previous appeal? You know, that there was evidence lacking, et cetera. And that to make these arguments now, and basically they were forfeited.
Well, I disagree wholeheartedly, obviously. Mr. Burns and his client were the appellants in that case. We were the respondents in that case. We were responding to their arguments in our brief, in our appeal. At that point in time, nobody had reviewed the trial court's evidence. Nobody had reviewed, you know, where this amount came from, this $716 amount was. We were simply responding to their arguments. I don't think that we have an affirmative duty as the respondent in a case to bring up alternative arguments as to why the court may have made a better finding than the court originally did. As we said before, the original argument the original finding from Judge Robin was that this was an expense that was duplicative of other expenses. So therefore our argument in response was that. So then when the Court of Appeals said, no, you can't have duplicative expenses, you then have to go and add that back to the budget. The first question that we had was, okay, well, is $716 the appropriate amount to add into the budget? And that's where we did the investigation into where did this $716 come from? And at that point, you know, that number became an issue because it wasn't based on any evidence that was supported by the record. So I don't think that there was any finding that Judge Robin made that would have clued any of us into assuming that we needed to make an argument at that point in time that there was another reason for Judge Robin not to include that in the budget at that time. I would also, you know, like we've talked about, this issue is that the trial court needs to figure out what is in a reasonable amount to put into the budget for Mr. J. Guardina. And I also want to talk about the part of my brief that discusses that the trial court made several findings regarding items that were not being allowed in Mr. J. Guardina's budget, but then never excluded them from Mr. J. Guardina's budget. And there's about $950 in Mr. J. Guardina's budget that the trial court excluded, but then never actually backed off that total number. So even if this court does find that perhaps the court should have put in something for a amount of a credit card payment, there is $960 in Mr. J. Guardina's budget that the trial court has available to essentially allocate and still have the same amount of spousal maintenance and child support in there. And also, if you look at Mr. J. Guardina's budget, he had an expense in his budget for credit card interest too. And that was not an item that was taken out either. So there is this payment that he was allowed of, what was it? Excuse me, it was like $361 for, $370.17 for credit card interest payments. So there is a payment for credit card expenses that was already included in his budget that the trial court did accept. And then the trial court did not actually take out the expenses that the trial court excluded for federal taxes and state taxes, which leaves more room in Mr. Jaywardena's budget too. So again, you know, this case has been pending for so long, and these parties have so much money and so much time invested in this. The trial court very meticulously reviewed what was in all of these budget items. There is room in Mr. Jaywardena's budget for a payment to a credit card. He did not provide any evidence for which the district court could surmise what a actual payment for this debt would be. Pursuant to the RAS court, the Newski court that we cite, and the Rye v. Cook case in our court, cited in our brief, if those expenses are not documented, if they're unsubstantiated, we can't include them in a budget. Even if they do exist, if there is no way that the trial court can come up with a number to plug in there. In the Rye v. Cook case, the Court of Appeals said expenses that were unsubstantiated were expenses for food, for, you know, gasoline for a car. I mean, everybody needs those expenses. But again, because there was no basis for where these numbers came from, you can't put them in a budget and then expect to have spousal maintenance and child support calculated based on these numbers that are just simply made up out of thin air. And you'll see from looking through the evidence that this $716 payment just simply comes from absolutely nowhere. And there is no way
I'm sorry, counsel, I'm just looking at the order of the district court. Said, on remand, husband argues that the court should simply take the amount he claimed he was paying toward the debt, $1,716, and add it to his monthly budget. Did husband provide testimony that he was paying that?
No. No, I've included all of the relevant portions of the transcript in the addendum. He testified, there was no testimony as to where that $716 came from. None.
That was a number, if I understand the record correctly, that was a number that was included on an exhibit as what he claimed it was his reasonable monthly expense. And that was about all we had.
All we have is a number plugged in a budget, Exhibit 8. That's all we have for that $716. Nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, Mr. Burns.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me first dispatch with any reference to this RASC case. The court is correct. That is an expense that was listed and not based on an existing obligation. So any argument to rely upon that, when what we have here is an actual present obligation, RASC does not apply. And as I point out in our reply brief, should be disregarded by this court. We heard some very good arguments from Ms. Walter today, but they're too late and too little. The fact is, if there was a question on the budget or a reason why the budget otherwise didn't stand up, those could have been made previously. It never should have been reopened to look at anything beyond what Judge Smith just pointed out, our position. The findings, when you read them in total, conclude that the $1,716 should be subtracted. And that's the recalculation that needs to happen. Take his budget, take $1,716 more, and then see if respondent's burden to show that my client has the ability to pay spousal maintenance is met. There's a $3,000 spousal maintenance obligation, $1,716 less ability per month to pay has a dramatic effect on that. That is where the analysis was supposed to be. If now there's this 2018 budget, and because I'm directed by the Court of Appeals, I do what I'm told to do, now I have to reduce that maintenance and that affects the child support. And respectfully, that's what I'm saying that the remand direction contemplates. There's the discussion up above, and then we therefore reverse and we want the district court to recalculate. Clearly, the only math that was contemplated was a subtraction of $1,716. And then clearly we have the regular spousal maintenance and child support analysis that goes with it. Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that getting a second judge on this case who then somewhat treated it as if it was a trial of first impression or that there was more for her to need to understand was a complicating factor. The directions from the Court of Appeals, the mandate was not followed. So for those reasons, we're asking for that specific instruction that I indicated to the court that I felt was appropriate, that we should say, subtract the 1716 and then do your spousal maintenance and child support analysis. For those reasons, we respectfully ask that the court move in that direction.
Just so I'm clear, you're asking, in response to my question about a specific instruction, you framed your instruction as if, correct me if I'm wrong, as if to best represent, as far as you believe, the prior Court of Appeals decision had intended.
That is correct. That is my intention. That consistent, and maybe that's the way I would phrase it, Your Honor, consistent with the previous Court of Appeals direction, we are instructing the lower court to subtract the $1,716.
And just so I'm clear on it, why do you believe if Judge Bjorkman intended to be that specific, she didn't include such language in the instruction in the first case?
I think it is in there. I think when you read the remand in total, you read the sentences leading up to the conclusion, and she talks about how the error undermines the court's calculation, and the only figure used is the 1716. I think when you read that in total, that is the only conclusion that can be drawn, because there's a finding that it's not a duplication, that it will continue to be incurred. I don't know that you can come to any other conclusion when you read it reasonably as a total direction.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. Enjoy the